listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's been a while, but we now know who's going back to the moon. NASA has announced who the crew will be. They'll be traveling faster and farther than any human since the Apollo 17 mission launched in 1972. 1A+ brings us a special feature, Ask an Astronaut. That's today at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now we spend the majority of our time in childhood around our immediate family, our parents, and our siblings, if any. Those relationships have a big influence on our development as we transition from childhood to teen years into our adult lives. A growing field of studies exploring the exact role that sibling relationships or being an only child can have on our personalities, our resilience, and our social dynamics. Our next guest is working on that research to help better understand how our families bond and how our bonds can make us who we are. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you were an only child or came from a big crew, how do you think that affected your childhood? How did your siblings or lack of siblings shape the person you are today? Tell us your best sibling story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anna Lindell is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater, where she researches child development and the role that parent and sibling relationships play in healthy development. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's great to be here today.
All right. We have a lot of close relationships potentially in our lives. What is unique about a sibling relationship from your perspective as a psychologist?
Yeah, well, compared to all of the relationships that we have in our lifetime, siblings are, if we have siblings, they can be one of the longest lasting relationships that we have. There's a quote that I love that says that our friends come and go, our parents eventually leave us, but our siblings are often the ones that we spend the majority of our lifespan with. And they're also kind of this quintessential love-hate relationship. So there are some very unique dynamics that we really don't see in any other close relationship that we have.
What are some of the big things you look for when it comes to how sibling relationships change over time, you know, from childhood through teen years and into adulthood?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the things that really influence the way that sibling relationships change is we have to think about how people change as they move through childhood and adolescence and into adulthood. And we have different kind of developmental tasks that we're all working on during those times. And our siblings kind of follow along with us. And so if we're thinking about really young children who have a sibling, obviously those two young children, they might spend a lot of time together, be very companionate with each other. But then as we start to get older, we start to maybe move away from our siblings a little bit and focus more on other relationships. So it can be pretty interesting to see the ways that those dynamics shift.
One assumption that I think was around for a long time, and if I understand correctly, research doesn't bear it out, is that there's something about only children, that not having siblings leads to certain personality traits, personality types, often over time viewed with suspicion. Is there anything at all to that, Anna?
Not in my current research. I would say that siblings, the way that we think about these relationships, they serve as an important support role for people. And if children are only children, they will ideally find that support in other relationships that they have. They might spend more time learning from their parents or from their peers, but if you have siblings, that can be a really rich source of socialization and support.
We are talking about siblings, our relationships with them, what they mean for our development as people. Anna Lindell is with us, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. She researches this, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have siblings, how has your relationship with them changed at different parts of your lives? Have they been an important part of your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an only child, do you wish you'd had siblings, as people might expect you to, or did you not see what the big deal was all about? 800-642-1234 is the number. Getting into how sibling relationships work, Anna, what are some of the characteristics of a strong, healthy sibling relationship?
Yeah, well, one of the unique things about sibling relationships is they are such a stable relationship that they can really withstand a lot and still end up okay in the end. So what we often look for in healthy sibling relationships, when children are younger, when they're in adolescence, we're looking for a lot of positive qualities. So are siblings spending a lot of time together, but is that time meaningful? Is there this expectation that that sibling will be there for them no matter what? Is there affection in that relationship? Is there nurturance in that relationship? Do siblings feel like they can trust and support one another? And even if siblings do have conflict, that's very typical. And it really just kind of shows how close those siblings are, because if we kind of think about the kinds of conflicts that children and adolescents have with their siblings, we're typically talking about squabbles that would come up just by virtue of being under the same roof. So that's not necessarily indicative of a poor sibling relationship. It's very expected and also provides a lot of training ground for how to resolve conflicts effectively.
When might a parent or someone look at a sibling relationship, maybe of their kids, and say, wait, this is above and beyond. This is not normal squabbles. This is actually something negative that we got to worry about.
Yeah, I think it comes down to looking at the balance between how frequently are those conflicts occurring, how intense are the conflicts. So if conflicts are very frequent, but also especially intense, without a whole lot of those other positive qualities going on, that could be a time where we might take a look at if there's something we can do to help maybe strengthen those relationships and maybe shift some of those relational qualities around a little bit. But frequent conflicts are not particularly problematic. We know that during late parts of middle childhood, early adolescence, siblings are going to fight. They're trying to assert their autonomy. They're trying to get their equal share. And so having frequent conflicts on their own, not particularly problematic in the long run.
For siblings who have had a difficult, maybe more than usual squabbling type of relationships as kids, what kind of things can they do as grownups when they've got some distance from that to reconnect and maybe confront and overcome those negative years?
Yeah, and there's actually been some research that we've done that's kind of looked at some of these changes after siblings do move apart from one another. So even if siblings maybe had pretty frequent conflicts when they were under one roof together during adolescence, we often find that having just some physical separation from their sibling can often be kind of a catalyst for restarting some of those relationships. And sometimes what we find is if siblings had a very negative relationship when they were living together, sometimes that might mean that those siblings do drift apart a little bit after they do separate, but sometimes it can also create a new opportunity to kind of rekindle that relationship, start to recognize what they value in that relationship once they've had a little bit of time to take a step back.
One thing I wonder about, my brother and I are about 5 years apart, and we were in different worlds as kids. We get along really well now. My daughters are twins, so they're like, minutes apart. Does the difference in age have a big bearing on how sibling relationships work?
Absolutely. So we absolutely find that siblings who are closer in age, they have a lot more overlap in shared activities that they enjoy. They're more likely to maybe share friend groups, share similar interests. They might attend the same schools even. And so we often find that those siblings tend to have closer relationships, also maybe more conflictive relationships. Whereas if we have siblings who are farther apart in age, we're often going to see maybe more of kind of like a junior parent type of relationship, at least when they're younger, because there is such a difference in maturity level and life experiences. And then those differences don't seem to make quite as much of a difference once we reach adulthood.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater psychology professor Anna Lindell about the way our siblings could shape our childhood and development and how those relationships change over the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have siblings? How have you stayed in touch over the years? Are you close friends, whether you are right next door to each other these days or live in different parts of the country or the world? Did having siblings make life easier or more difficult for you growing up? If you're an only child, same question. Did you think that was easier, harder, or it's just what it was? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Anna Lindell. She's a psychology professor at UW-Whitewater. She's with us today to talk about siblings and how having siblings or not having them can influence our development from being kids through our adult lives and the relationships that we have with them through the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to give a shout out to the brother or sister in your life, how your relationship has changed over time, how you stay in touch, maybe even if you've moved apart geographically? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, Rob. Hey. So this is a little more about, I guess, uncles and less my siblings, but I heard your guest talking about, I think it was twins or siblings who are closer in age earlier, and it reminded me of my Irish twin uncles who, you know, looked almost identical. They were short, blonde, blue boys, and they were really close together. They don't look that way anymore, believe me, but those guys were always doing stuff together. And I think until my older uncle was going into first grade and my younger uncle into kindergarten, my younger uncle thought that they were in fact twins until my older uncle's first grade teacher came up to him and said, "Sorry, Paul, you and Tom are not twins," Paul being the younger of the two uncles. And so that always struck me.
That's a great family story, Jack. Thanks a lot for that at 800-642-1234. Very close in an earlier generation, Anna. Have we seen changes in the closeness of our sibling relationships over the generations?
You know, that's an interesting question. And that's one that I think we'd have to think more about in terms of what part in the lifespan we're talking about. So I think if we're thinking about maybe older adolescents, now we see a lot more reliance on peer relationships and friendships and spending a lot of time outside of the home context in among today's adolescents. And so I think we might see maybe siblings perhaps spending less time together among today's adolescents. We certainly see changes in how likely it is that siblings will see each other frequently once they reach adulthood, as we kind of have people spreading out geographically more than in the past. But it's an interesting question historically to think about how these have changed over time. Yeah.
Jack, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk about siblings, hoping you can answer some of the questions that our guest, Anna Lindell from UW-Whitewater, just brought up. Do you feel like it's easy to stay in touch with your siblings? Is it something you want to do? Do you get a lot of joy from being in contact with your siblings? Does it seem like we do less of that over time? And hey, parents out there, if you have stories of your kids and how they get along as siblings, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anna, what kind of things are you focusing your research on right now when it comes to sibling relationships?
Yeah, well, for a long time, we really didn't have much of a sense of how siblings maintain their relationships once they're no longer living under the same roof. And so what my current research is trying to do is trying to figure out, well, how do siblings best stay in touch with one another? And what benefits can siblings have once they may no longer be spending as much time together? So I'm really particularly interested in how college-aged siblings maintain their relationships and how sometimes we forget that siblings can be a really important resource for students who have siblings, particularly if we're thinking about first-generation college students who may not have parents or many other family members who've gone through the college experience before. Siblings might be a particularly valuable source of information, source of support that might help mitigate some of the challenges that first-gen students often have.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Rhinelander. John, hi.
Hi. I'm hearing a lot of sunshine going on about siblings. I grew up in a family that was rife with alcoholism, violence, and sexual abuse, which you would think would draw siblings close together. I have four siblings. None of us have spoken to each other in probably 10 or 15 years. Two or three of us actually actively detest each other. I am kind of sad that that's how it ended up, but just another direction.
John, thank you so much for being willing to share that with us. And I'm sorry things went that way. John brings up something I was hoping to get to, Anna. things don't always work well. There are families that are very dysfunctional and have bad things going on. What do you look for in those kinds of sibling relationships?
Yeah, and in situations like that, we often find that when families are experiencing significant levels of stress, especially chronic stress, we can find sibling relationships can kind of go one of two different ways. So there's been a good amount of research looking at divorce as one context that has found that sometimes siblings, in light of that major life stressor, sometimes it pulls siblings closer together, but in many cases, it does lead siblings to kind of separate from one another. And that's a lot of that has to do with the particular circumstances surrounding the events in the family, but a lot of it also has to do with how close the siblings were kind of in the first place. So sometimes if siblings were very close, they might lean on each other. In other cases, they may not see their siblings as a particularly valuable source of support. And so we can absolutely see some of those types of events leading to separation from siblings, more feelings of indifference towards siblings, feelings of antagonism and dislike of siblings. So we can absolutely see it going either direction. Yes.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Anna Lindell, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. She researches, among other things, sibling relationships, what they mean for us as we develop from kids into adults. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Morning, afternoon. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Jim?
Well, all I want to tell you is I come from a large family. There was nine of us. We're nine within 14 years, but we're all in our 60s and 70s now. We're all different. Yet we're very close. You know, it could be if somebody from the old neighborhood died or passed away or moved someplace, I could go be away from my phone for an hour and come back and it's like a pack of firecrackers going off in my pocket because there's so many texts going back and forth.
And Jim, do you live, do the nine of you live all over the country now or are you mostly here in Wisconsin? How does that affect things?
Mostly in the Midwest. You know, if there's a gathering, we probably get together, I don't know, 3 to 5, 6 times a year. And if there's a gathering, it's, you know, there's probably seven of us that show up anyway.
Interesting. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that. Glad you're still in touch with everybody. A big group of siblings there, Anna.
Yeah, and I love that sibling context that the caller described, because what we often find is, especially once people kind of get into past the early part of adulthood, we often find siblings rekindling those relationships again, and they can be a great source of support and companionship. And it's almost like they pick up right where they left off, despite all of the busyness that we often get in earlier parts of adulthood. We absolutely find siblings maintaining those close relationships. And today it's even easier than ever to keep those ties close with all the forms of technology that we have. It's really exciting.
Jim, thanks for that call. Susie is with us now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. My parents considered it extremely important for us to get along, the four of us kids. I'm number three out of the four within 5 years, and we're in that time zone where everybody just had a pile of kids all at once. Anyway, we passed that on to our children. I had two little kids. When they were little, if they argued with each other, and they got along real well most of the time, but if they got into an argument and I had enough of it, then I would say, all right, you two, hold hands, look at each other in the eye, and you have to say two things about each other that you really like, but it can't have anything to do with how they look. And so they'd have to stand there until they could actually say the two things, and it was always so cute. But they only got to do it a couple of times because after they realized that I was serious about this and I was going to keep doing it, they started arguing. I'd come in the room, they'd go, oh, wait, don't argue because Mama's here. She's going to make us do that again. And so they didn't have to do it very often, but they're 39 and 36 and a half and still very, very dear friends, even though one lives in Tulsa and the other one lives in Washington State.
Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Anna, whether it's Susie's example or something else, are there things that parents can do to help cultivate happy relationships among their kids?
Yeah, and especially thinking about how parents can kind of foster those positive sibling relationships, we absolutely find that parents should celebrate and acknowledge their children's differences among one another. Some of the callers have mentioned how they're very different, but also very similar. And I think that parents really should work very hard not to compare their children with one another, and really kind of acknowledge what makes each of their children unique, because then that'll reduce the possibility of sibling rivalry. Siblings will feel less like their parents are treating them unfairly compared to their sibling. And I think doing whatever parents can do to encourage those positive relationships, spending time with each other as a family, but also giving them their own space and autonomy as well.
And thanks for that call. And just in our last minute, Anna, she mentioned she was the, I think, third of four. Another popular psychology thing, birth order matters. If you're the first kid or the seventh kid or whatever, it affects your personality. Just like some of the only childhood stuff, does research bear that out?
Not so much. Sometimes we might find that firstborn being a little bit more independent. But I think a big difference is the way that parents treat their children. So sometimes parents treat the first child as a first draft, and then they think about their younger children, and they learn from their experiences with their older ones. So there might be a little bit of truth to it, but not as much as we might think.
Anna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Anna Lindell, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater, where she researches child development and the role that parent and sibling relationships play in healthy development. She was with us today to talk about the role that having siblings or being an only child plays in our development over the years. Still time for you to share your own story, if you'd like, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or just give a shout out to a sibling, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time: what makes a good apology and what makes a bad one? Sometimes it's harder than you think to make amends. We'll get some great advice on the topic with the authors of a new book called Sorry, Sorry, Sorry. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with a family that cooks Chinese food together. They share their secrets with us in the new cookbook, The Walks of Life. That's tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the leaked Defense Department documents and how it could all affect Ukraine, the U.S., and allies. First, have you ever found yourself stuck in traffic and thinking to yourself, there's got to be a better way? Cars are supposed to offer us independence, and roads are supposed to make it easier for us to get around. But our guest this afternoon lives in Chicago, where drivers spend roughly 4 days a year stuck in traffic jams while our freeways have divided and, in some cases, decimated communities. Our guest's new book asks us to re-examine our relationship with our automobiles and consider shifting our transportation priorities toward those that do the least amount of damage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your car is worth the cost? Do you wish there were other, maybe better transportation alternatives to the automobile in your community? Have you ever been to a place or lived in a place where it was easy to get around and do all the stuff you want to do without a car? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Knowles is the Midwest correspondent for The Economist and author of the new book, Carmageddon: How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you ever so much for having me on. I'm delighted.
I want to make a distinction right up front here, Daniel. The theme of your book is not people who drive cars are bad, but we've made decisions over the past century plus that make it so you, in many cases, don't have a choice but to take a car. Can you spell out that distinction in what you're shooting for here?
Exactly. It's kind of a collective action problem. I think that basically, you know, if you're the only person who has a car, having a car is great. You know, they get you from A to B really, really quickly, really well. But the problem is that when everybody gets a car, everything spreads out in such a way that it kind of stops alternatives from working, and you kind of have to have a car. You know, the way that a lot of American cities, and actually some, quite a few cities in Europe too and elsewhere in the world, are designed, it's very difficult to do without a car. And part of the problem is because there are so many cars. You know, cars use up so much land, they force cities to sprawl, and when everything has so much parking and road space, you kind of need a car because everybody else has a car. So it's not that you're individually at fault, it's that kind of you're being forced to get a car by how everything's set up.
I want to look at one key turning point you write about in American history, and other countries have faced a similar problem. cars start to show up and people are very offended. You are infringing on my freedom to walk on a street. I have to watch out for this car that might run me over. People form organizations. They hold safety parades worried about cars. Then what happens to flip things around?
So, I mean, it's fascinating reading the history of that period, because exactly as you say, cars were not kind of initially accepted as this great, wonderful invention. You know, people were really upset. They killed a lot of people. They were dangerous and they took the road away. And you had these protests, you know, and particularly in America, what happened essentially was in part a kind of organized lobbying effort. And you had motor dealerships, car dealerships, and wealthier people and people, you know, who kind of had an interest in cars, began to lobby for things like jaywalking laws, for things like the building of expressways. You know, the idea being, oh, we'll separate the fast traffic from the people, which, you know, did reduce deaths, but meant that you kind of led to the spreading out of cities and the dependence on cars. And that created this environment where basically people sort of, as some people got cars, it became harder for the people without cars to get by. You know, as cars proliferated, streetcar networks, which is how most American cities kind of used to work up until about the 1930s, they suddenly didn't work very well because they were always stuck in traffic. So sort of as some people got cars, it became that kind of very difficult for you to keep going without a car. So more people had to get a car. And of course, it was this aspirational thing, but over time, it just became sort of, you know, you're running to catch up. We kind of, your cars drive your distance, a further distance faster, but actually everywhere is just further apart than it used to be. So you're spending as much time traveling as you were before, you know, before we had any cars at all. And that's kind of what's happened sort of all over the world, actually.
Before I get into the harm side of things, one more trend you track is this idea. Okay, we got a lot of cars, so there's a lot of congestion. So obviously we make more lanes, whether that's adding lanes to current roads or adding newer, faster roads along the way, that will logically cure the congestion problem. What actually happens?
So I actually have a great example of this at the moment, which is kind of the opposite. It's the Kennedy Expressway in Chicago, which is near my house. Right now, there have been several lanes closed, you know, a lot of the time over the last couple of weeks, as they're rebuilding it. And of course, you know, a lot of the local media, a lot of people are very worried about all of the traffic and talked about it. And what's actually happened is that, you know, people have anticipated that traffic is bad and they've changed the times that they travel and more people are getting on the metro trains and people have adjusted. And actually what's happened, there was some data I saw yesterday, is that sometimes at rush hour, traffic on the Kennedy has actually been better than it was with the lanes closed than it was when it was open. Now, obviously people have had to adjust. There's not, you know, there are no costs to this. But what happens when you widen a freeway is the opposite. People kind of, you know, they think, oh, well, it's wider, it will be faster. And for a little while it is. But over time, everybody kind of adjusts how they act and it gets slower because you just get more cars on the road. So people take journeys that they wouldn't have driven or they go further than they would have otherwise done. And the traffic's as bad as it was before, you know, and that can happen really quite quickly. And in cities, if you widen highways, the evidence is pretty clear that you don't really reduce the congestion at all. You actually increase it because people drive journeys that they probably wouldn't have driven before. So you get more cars on the road, you know, that uses up the traffic space of the extra lanes and then means more cars on all the kind of feeder roads too.
Talking to Daniel Knowles, his new book is called Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the car culture we've built up here in the United States? Do you have fixes in mind? Are there things you'd like to see changed? Do you have questions for our guest about the work he did in this book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Daniel, part of the subtitle of the book, How Cars Make Life Worse. Let's get into some of the things you see as harm. First of all, to neighborhoods and urban communities as we expand these roads, what do you see as the main consequences there?
Well, I think it just makes it neighborhoods that people drive, you know, that everybody has to drive in, they're not, they don't, they can be quite isolating, particularly if you don't have a car. But it means that, you know, you no longer are able to walk down the street to pick up a pint of milk. You know, you may be less likely to know your neighbors. And you have things like supermarkets. You know, it's a real problem in lots of communities in, you know, here in Chicago, but lots of communities in America, that you won't have somewhere that you can do grocery shopping nearby, because essentially these kind of huge supermarkets, you know, that rely on everybody driving to them, kind of dominate the market. And so I think kind of they make life more fractious. There's also quite a lot of evidence that if you're reliant on your car for a commute, that it's the least sort of makes people unhappy in a direct way. Driving is actually quite stressful. You know, you have to focus on the road ahead of you. It's unpredictable. You know, you don't know whether you're going to arrive in 40 minutes or an hour, you know, depending on the traffic. And that means that people are kind of stressed out about how bad the traffic might be, and I think it makes people, yeah, quite stressed out in a way that's also not a direct kind of economic cost, and but is something that you have to sort of count too, and you know, adds, I think, to our general sense sometimes, particularly living here in America, but kind of you know, we're not perfect in Europe at all, that life is very exhausting and tiring, is how much time we're spending dealing, piloting these vehicles around all day.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Janet is with us in Madison. Janet, hi.
Hi. I had noticed that I wasn't driving a lot, and it seemed kind of crazy that all our cars sit around parked 95% of the time. So 2 years ago, I started a car share program, and we now have 13 people in the program. We're driving two cars, and we may be looking at getting a third. And one of the great things about this is it's very economical. But also, when people are sharing a car, they actually stop and think about their driving, and they drive less and consider taking the bus or a bike or walking or combining trips more than when they invest so much into their private car.
Interesting, Janet. Thanks for sharing that. Daniel, what do you think?
Janet, I think that's absolutely brilliant. I'm a member of Zipcar because, you know, every now and again, even if you're somebody like me who goes everywhere on a bike, you do need a car. You know, you do need to go and pick up something heavy or whatever. And so I use Zipcar, and I wish they were more available, because I think what's really good about car sharing programs is that one of the problems with cars, how it works at the moment, is that, you know, cars are very expensive up front. You know, you've got to buy one. It might, you know, you've got to pay insurance. You've got to have somewhere to park it. But, you know, you're paying all of those kind of upfront costs to own a car. But then once you've sort of got it, you know, it does sit parked most of the time, and actually driving it kind of an extra mile is quite cheap. It's just the cost of the gasoline you're putting in it. And so people buy cars because, you know, they do have that one trip, or they have certain things that they, yeah, maybe they do really need a car for that. But then once they've got it, you think you might as well use it for every journey, because you've paid for it already. And car sharing, I think, can kind of change some of the dynamics of that a bit. It means that you don't have to pay the whole cost of a car. You split it with some people. You've still got one available for when you really need a car. But you look at the cost as the marginal cost, as the cost of that one journey when you're using it, rather than, you know, the $11,000 or whatever you're spending on. I mean, that's actually the total cost of owning a car on average in the US, but whatever your car payment is, you're not thinking, well, I've paid that anyway. You're thinking, oh, I could do this journey in a car for $10, or I guess I could get on my bike and save that this time. So it means that each time you're kind of considering, you know, the like real cost at a time. And when that happens, people use their cars less. And so I think, you know, car sharing, I have a lot of hope for.
Janet, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Daniel Knowles, Midwest correspondent for The Economist, author of the new book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. We're looking at how our commitment to cars, he says, has created lots of unintended consequences, what it might take to find more alternatives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel stuck, like you have to have a car to do anything? Do you wish there were more alternatives? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Daniel Knowles, Midwest correspondent at The Economist and author of the book Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. We're looking at how cars have helped to shape our communities for better or worse and the decisions that could shape the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the best ways to cure traffic congestion? What would it take for you to live and work without a car? You think it's possible? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in New London. Mike, hi.
Hi, Daniel and Rob. I appreciate you getting me on the air. I actually was working on a little essay I enjoy writing, and I'm titling it Reflections on a Dead Woodcock, which is a little game bird in the state of Wisconsin and others. And we happened to see it this week walking the town, my wife and I, but that a car had obviously run it over along with other roadkill that you see, you know, every day. But I think cars have impacted the divisiveness in our society in the following way. If you think of it, back in the horse and buggy days, which was only 100 years ago, people needed each other. You helped each other. You were considerate. Look at then, early autos weren't very trustworthy. And over the course of years, I'm 60-something now, you hurtle along in this little enclosed unit. You don't, in a sense, need anybody. You're not close to anybody except maybe to give them the finger, you know, if you're upset. And the second, that's how they hurt divisiveness. You don't need anybody. Like gotcha. We used to.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Daniel, this idea of social isolation if the car is our main mode of transportation, Mike says.
I think that's absolutely right. It's actually is almost a better answer to one of your earlier questions than the one I gave myself. You know, and I think kind of for if you look at the history of segregation in America, you know, racial segregation, and it goes hand in hand with the car. And I write about this in the book, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, as kind of formal legal segregation began to be, you know, undermined finally, and black people were given civil rights. And over an awful lot of cities essentially began to use freeway construction, you know, as a way of getting, of essentially kind of reinforcing racial segregation. And if you look at, you know, I wrote about Atlanta a bit in the book, one of several places, but you know, if you're in your own car, your own individual car, you don't have to share space with somebody of another race. And I think in a lot of countries, actually, particularly countries with very high levels of inequality, you know, I used to live in India and I used to live in Kenya, and I wrote about them in the book too. You know, countries where, you know, the rich really are kind of on a different level to the poor, even more so than in America. There's a real sort of horror of the idea that you might have to share space, share public transport with, you know, with much poorer people. And and it leads to this very kind of car-centric development in those countries too. And so I think there is that, I think there's a lot to that kind of observation. It's a sort of way of, a car shelters you to some extent from the community, the society you're moving through while you're in it. So you don't have to engage with it as much. And perhaps then, you know, if you are on the kind of privileged side of that divide, you're protected a bit from it too. So
thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Daniel Knowles about his new book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Daniel, I want to get to the what to do about it part a little bit now. And you point toward a number of communities, cities around the world that you see taking steps in the right direction. What do you see as the most inspirational?
So I wrote a whole chapter about Tokyo, and in fairness, this is perhaps not the most inspirational the right way, because Tokyo sort of was never dominated by cars. They, after World War II, you know, it was kind of flattened, obviously, in the war, but the way it was rebuilt was in this way that it's you can have a car in Tokyo, and lots of Japanese people do own cars, and, you know, in fact, there are a whole kind of you know, car nuts, people who love their cars. But what you don't, what you have is a world where it's very difficult to park your car. Parking is not free. You know, or street parking almost non-existent. You have to pay tolls to use the expressways, and the public transport's extremely good. And so people choose mostly not to use their cars unless, you know, that's something special or something where they really need it for. And I think that's a kind of the city that's doing best. But I also think inspirational, you know, I say talk about Paris and Copenhagen, but actually one place in this region, which I think has been doing some remarkable stuff in recent years is Minneapolis, which has built some, you know, I was there last summer and I was there recently, and, you know, the public transport's not terrible, but they've built incredible bike lanes, and they're building, so, you know, they have so many new apartments and homes going up near the city center, near where the jobs are, so that, you know, if you live in one of those places, you won't have to commute, you know, 30, 40 miles to get to work in your car each day. You could probably get there on a bicycle if you want to. And so I think there's some quite inspirational stuff happening, you know, in various parts of America that we, you know, where we still think of as being very car-centric cities. So I think it is happening.
Time for one more caller. Laura is with us in Cudahy. Laura, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to agree with one of your previous callers talking about how a car can isolate one. I'm 64. I've been riding the bus my whole life. And one of the things that I love about taking the bus is that I'm not isolated from others. I am exposed to so many different kinds of people as I go through so many different neighborhoods. It makes me feel connected to others, and it also makes, I feel like it helps me to be a better human being because I just feel connected to people. And I had also wanted to say, Rob, I know that you sometimes talk about waiting for the bus, and I really appreciate that because it kind of normalizes, you know, people taking public transportation. I think we need so much more of that in this country.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. And Daniel, it's easy for me to talk about taking the bus. I happen to have a house near half the bus lines in town and a workplace that's the same. That's not necessarily a viable option for a large percentage of the population. What would it take to have my experience riding the bus and Laura's more inviting and accessible?
I mean, you know, in America, I think just investing in buses would be a pretty good start. But, you know, a lot of American cities, you know, Canadian cities look quite similar to American cities in terms of the spread, the layout, the grids, the rest of it. And they have twice as much kind of bus service on average, as a study I read recently. So having more buses would be the good thing. I also think that sometimes there are certain kind of trade-offs that we have to make. And I, you know, sometimes American cities tend to see buses as public services for the very poor. And so they will make sure that there's a bus that, you know, for people who don't have cars at all and can't use them. And so they'll make sure that a bus can take you to every part of the city. And that's good. You know, you do want that. But one of the problems is that if you have a bus, you know, if your buses go everywhere, but they only go once every hour, they're not a very, you know, they're not really a practical alternative to driving for an awful lot of people. You need frequent buses. And you know, I'm a Londoner and I've moved to Chicago and I use the buses here in Chicago. And actually, when you get on the bus in Chicago, it's great because it's a grid. They get there pretty quickly, but you end up waiting for them really quite often too long. And then they do get stuck in traffic, and so I think kind of doing things to speed up the buses too, so that they, you know, can move down their own lanes, that sort of thing. So that, you know, that way you can turn them into a really good alternative to driving, because, you know, you don't have to park the bus, you just get on it, you get off it. And, you know, apart from all the other benefits of, yeah, you get to share space, you get to see the neighborhoods, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to drive, you can look at your phone or you can read a book or whatever. So I think buses can actually be pretty great. But it takes work, and it takes kind of treating them as a very serious alternative to driving.
And we'll leave it there. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Daniel Knowles. His new book is Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Read a lot of that on the bus today. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.